In a dream, I heard this tune. When I woke up, I thought, what is it? Is it Fred Astaire? Is it Cole Porter? What is it?
Paul McCartney, as you've never heard him before, sharing the personal stories behind 10 of his songs.
I was wandering around and saw a shop sign that read Rigby. And I thought, that's it.
Paul McCartney, inside the songs.
And if I say I really loved you, there it is, I've said it.
Begins tonight as part of Front Row from 7:15 on Radio 4. Or hear the podcast now on BBC Sounds.
And then following Front Row, we return to the subject of climate change at 8. The worst effects are often framed as a problem for the future, but for some, the worst has already happened. As world leaders prepare to gather in Glasgow to talk about how to bring down emissions, Radio 4 will tell the story of a place in the crosshairs of climate change, where people don't just have to imagine the future, they're now figuring out how to rebuild it. In June, the Canadian village of Lytton smashed national heat records 3 days running, reaching an astonishing 49.6 Celsius. Then it burned to the ground. Just one example of a summer of fire and flood, which begins tonight, straight after the news at 8. We'll strike a lighter tone first, though, as we join John Lloyd and his new curator, Holly Walsh.
The Museum of Curiosity.
Hello, my name's John Lloyd, and I'm the Professor of Ignorance at Southampton Sonnet University. Welcome to the Museum of Curiosity. Larger than the Louvre, more engaging than the Guggenheim, and with a slightly better safety record than the Texas Chainsaw Museum. And I'm joined once again by our curator, acclaimed writer and comedian, Holly Walsh.
Hello, John.
Hello, Holly, and how's business?
Yeah, you know, not too bad, Professor. I've been trying to make sense of the museum bookshop this week. Since so many of our donations divide time, space and conventional logic, we've started selling books that haven't actually been written yet.
Well, I imagine that puts something of a strain on the authors.
You're not wrong there. Dame Hilary Mantle was as surprised as anyone when it turned out her next novel is about a kindly hedgehog with X-ray vision.
Oh, what's it called?
Terry.
No, I meant the book.
Oh, no idea, sorry.
Oh. Anyway, let me introduce today's steering committee. Comedian Evelyn Mock, historian Dr. Alan Withy, and literary chameleon Alan Scott.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
So today we've all dialed in from different parts of the world, believe it or not. Evelyn, where are you joining us from?
I am joining you from Gothenburg in Sweden, or as we Gothenburgians call it, the front side of Sweden. Because there's a little bit of a bicker between Gothenburg and Stockholm. Gothenburg is on the west coast, and so we call it the front side, and we deem Stockholm on the east coast the backside of the country.
And what does Stockholm call you?
They just call us jealous.
And Alan, whereabouts are you?
I'm in the south of France, behind Saint-Tropez, but it still takes about 2.5 hours to get there if you want to go.
Dr. Withy, are you somewhere exotic?
I'm in the South Wales town of Caerphilly on the northern slopes of Caerphilly Mountain, where it's currently 1956 and drizzling.
Good castle, though, isn't it, Caerphilly?
Yes, built in a weird place, though. It's built at the bottom of a hill, which you kind of think would be a slight defensive disadvantage, wouldn't it?
Evelyn,
yes.
You're a comedian and actor and have appeared on Mock the Week, Hypothetical, and the Swedish version of Would I Lie to You?
Mm-hmm.
You won a Pleasance Indie Award for your debut show, Hymen Maneuver. You co-host the podcast Rice to Meet You, and your upcoming Radio 4 sketch show is Drop the Dead Panda. So we know there are no dead pandas in it, but what can we expect?
So it is a sketch show about East Asian and Southeast Asian culture. It's a playoff of Drop the Dead Donkey, which was a sitcom, but this is going to be a sketch show.
It's so hard to name things at the best of times.
With my history, I have Hymen Maneuver as a title, so I'm not the best namer of things.
So you might as well have called it The Archer's Panda, The News at Panda.
Have I got pandas for you?
Or Goodness Gracious Panda.
So what can we expect, Evelyn, in terms of, give us some secrets of East Asian culture that we, can you have some spoiler alerts here?
I think we're going to explore sort of the diaspora experience of how it is to grow up as an East Asian person in Britain. So we're going to talk about coming out to our parents as creatives. My parents still don't understand what I do. My dad the other day, as he was driving me to take the train to go to Stockholm to do an acting job, he was telling me that maybe it was time for me to look up an actual job. He suggested that I become a police officer because it's a respectable job. And they're also hiring minorities right now because the Swedish police are trying to become more diverse, and also women. So he said it would be a perfect job for me and it's respectable. But he was doing this as he was driving me to go to work as a creative person.
I was going to ask you, I was looking up Swedish, and is it true that Swedes don't say in Swedish, beat around the bush, but they say, you walk like a cat around hot porridge?
Yeah. We have, you walk like a cat around hot porridge, or you walk like a cow on thin ice. I'm not sure where the sayings come from.
I don't even understand the expression, beat around the bush.
Well, it's in case there's a cat in there, you see. You try and drive the cat out because it's probably in the bush eating the porridge, I imagine.
But if you're beating around a bush, isn't that a good way of getting something out quickly?
No, you're missing the central point.
So what are you supposed to be hitting?
The bush.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Evelyn. I think you're probably Sweden's most interesting export since meatballs with furniture. Coming to you now, Dr. Withy, you're an award-winning historian and senior lecturer at the University of Exeter. You were named a BBC New Generation Thinker, run a popular history blog and podcast, and recently completed a three-year study funded by the Wellcome Trust entitled Do Beards Matter? Do They?
Well, I'm duty-bound to say yes. It's the problem with of being a beards historian, if you put it that way, is that it's quite a quirky topic, and quite often when you tell people what you do, they sort of almost look at you as if to say you're joking, right? But no, I'm not joking. It's actually been a serious academic study about what is actually the beard. It's a very important part of the history of masculinity, of male appearance, of, you know, how guys want to look, or in a sense, how they feel across different points of time. So it's all about, you know, how the beard is meshed up in all these different meanings, and it's thrown up quite a lot of different interesting quirky bits and pieces along the way, though, admittedly.
So do you call yourself a pogonologist?
Other people have done that. I've been called all sorts of things. When my project launched, it got taken up by some of the tabloid newspapers, and I was called things like beards boffin, facial hair guru, and once the maven of shaving.
Alan, your PhD was on 17th and 18th century Welsh medicine. What sort of stuff did you come across? Any cures that we could readopt from Welsh medicine in the 18th century?
Well, some of them you wouldn't want to because they're frankly deadly. but I mean, you know, along the gentler end of things, I mean, I always like things like frying cobwebs in salad oil as a means to cure an upset stomach. There's various weird and wonderful ones that stay with me. Squatting over the bucket of hot milk to cure constipation. And it actually says in the remedy, if I can remember, as hot as the party can bear it.
That's brilliant.
People often ask me what my favourite of all 17th century remedies is, and this is one would be called oil of swallows. This involves catching various numbers, up to 20 live swallows. Then you have to put them into a large earthenware pot, which, if you think of the logistics of this, means that you maybe catch your one or two, you open the pot and you shove them in the pot and close the lid very quickly, I would imagine, before they fly out. You go and get two more, open the lid, the first two fly out, and very quickly, you know, things are descending. Then you have to bake them to a powder, then put the pot into the hottest dunghill you can find for up to 2 weeks. And I'm not making this up. And then the oil is ready to use.
I think you should audition for Bake Off.
Bake Off, yes. Oil of Swallows. I'll be cooking Oil of Swallows for you today. And yeah, I can imagine serving that up to the celebrity judges. I mean, a lot of these things sound utterly weird and, you know, frankly frightening to us. But they are based on a very logical system of understanding the body. And this is what I tell my students when I'm teaching this, that once you understand the body as people in the 17th century did, then this stuff makes perfect sense. And nothing in any of the remedies that I mentioned to you would raise an eyebrow in the 17th no. century. It's just all perfectly orthodox, standard stuff.
Well, thank you, Dr. Allen. Inspired by your beard project, I'm going to stop shaving, at least until the end of the programme. Now, Alan Scott, for over 30 years, you combined screenwriting and producing with chairing a famous Scotch whisky company. You wrote one of my all-time favourite films, Don't Look Now, adapted Priscilla, Queen of the Desert as a smash hit stage show, penned the film version of Roald Dahl's The Witches, and most recently the screenplay for Netflix's wildly successful series, The Queen's Gambit. So, did you have to really bone up on chess for that? Did you play chess before?
No. I did, but I mean only just in an amateurish way. In fact, the key, I think, to the success of the series was every time there was a chess game that was narratively important, we had to find a way of communicating what was happening without anybody understanding chess. We had to audition it for people who didn't understand chess. And that was slightly screwed up for us by Garry Kasparov, who we hired as an expert to advise us. And the first thing he said when I met him for lunch, he'd got the script the night before, so he'd read 6 or 7 episodes overnight. And he sat down at the table and he said, very good. He said, well, everything you've got right, the chess is fine. He said, there is one thing, however. Nobody in our level of chess ever says check or checkmate. It just is not a word you speak. Because they understand what the position is in the game. And I said, well, how are we going to tell the audience how she's doing? He said, you have to find another way. And he then gave me something that is on my iPhone that I keep to this day for anybody I come across who actually likes chess. I said, show me your most fun endgame. And he showed me in 3 moves how you sacrifice your queen and checkmate the next move. It was just a treat. We then had 2 more chess experts on the set every day, setting the games out. Anyway, it's not really about chess. It's about the price of genius and the pain of addiction and other stories.
So let's just talk about your other life for a minute, Alan. Yes, yes. All those years in the whiskey industry. I mean, as the chairman, could you whip up a batch?
Yes, I could run you up a batch. In fact, I have done it in the kitchen. It wasn't very tasty. And of course, the most important element in fine Scotch whiskey is maturation.
Are you supposed to drink whiskey on the rocks or with water or with...
The answer is you can drink it whichever way you want. I mean, literally, that's true. I used to secretly drink mine with Coca-Cola. Now, I'm not going to tell people that because I was making one of the finest products on earth. But that's how I liked it. They came up, the Scotch Whisky Association asked me to go to America and publicize Scotch whisky generically. And as I got to the States, they said, oh, we've come up with a great idea. It's whisky is a real cocktail ingredient. I said, like what? They said, how about a Scotch Bloody Mary? Mm-hmm. I thought, oh my God, that has to be the most disgusting thing I've ever heard. I tasted it. It was actually quite good.
Oh, amazing.
Did you call it Bloody Mary, Queen of Scots?
I think they tried all of those variations, yes.
Well, thank you so much, Alan. Like a fine single malt, you have aged beautifully and are a perfect accompaniment to smoked fish. Now, Madam Curator, have you prepared another stirring fanfare with which to declare the museum open for donations?
I absolutely have, Professor, and I've been practising the Mongolian nose flute all week.
Ooh. Ah, so that wasn't a reusable drinking straw left on my desk earlier?
No, sorry. I meant to tell you that sooner, but you just really seem to be enjoying that milkshake. So anyway, I now declare the museum open for donations. Evelyn, what would you like to donate to the museum?
Well, Holly and John, I would like to offer the museum Sweden's Dragon Gate because I feel like it represents what I am. I am a Chinese girl born and raised in Sweden, and Dragon Gate is a Chinese thing that is in Sweden.
Dragongate sounds a bit like a scandal, is it?
It kind of became a scandal. So I think during the 90s, it used to be just a regular kind of gas stop or service point by a highway outside of Stockholm going up north. And the service point wasn't doing very well. It was always constantly sold to different people. And then in the early noughties, it was sold to a Chinese businessman who bought the place. And he, in his mind, had this idea to create the first Chinatown in Sweden at this service point. And he basically made it look like a small piece of China by the motorway in the Swedish countryside. He was going to open a Shaolin temple that teaches Kung Fu. And then also, yes, he was going to bring a panda in from China. And he'd never managed to do any of that, but he managed to bring a full replica of the Chinese terracotta army.
Wow.
So he just kind of got tired of all of the red tape. So he just abandoned it. And now, now it's just a regular gas station.
I looked up Dragon Gate online. Apparently, Dragon Gate's also a sect of Taoism.
Oh, really?
Which I didn't know before. Yeah. Interestingly, on pandas, did you know that all pandas belong to China legally? Mm-hmm. And that any born outside China have to be repatriated to China? It's done by FedEx. And apparently, if China is out, they leave them in Mongolia.
Can I ask you, in Sweden, is there a Chinatown or equivalent of?
No, it's just my parents' house, I
think. So Dragon Gate is the equivalent of Chinatown. It's the closest thing you've got.
It's, yeah, exactly. I think that was his hope. He wanted to open a Chinatown, but it's just a location, location, location.
We have a weird tradition in the UK with our service stations whereby we used to have these chains called Happy Eaters or Little Chefs, and they pretty much across the board sold everything with chips and beans. But they always had these bizarre, huge, grey slides in the garden areas of them that you'd drive down motorways and there'd just be a huge fiberglass dragon that children would just be climbing all over and sliding down. And that's really something that's, I guess, for health and safety reasons, really fallen by the wayside because you don't see them anymore. But when I was a kid, every motorway trip was spent trying to spot one of these giant creatures with children running around in them. But there is definitely something odd about that oasis of a motorway service station that you hold out for ages.
The one thing I can never understand is that some of them now have amusement arcades in and quite often have driving games. And you just think, why would I have just... I've stopped here to get away from driving. Why do I now want to play a computerized driving game?
Another thing they always have is a massage machine where you sit in a chair and it massages your back, but it's always directly next to the men's urinals. And I think how unrelaxing is that to have the smell of urine while you're getting your back rubbed, but each their own. So finally, Evelyn, would you like to move the whole Dragon Gate complex into the museum or just your favourite parts of it?
I would like to give you all of it because I feel like we can't just do parts because it would be too misleading. So I think we need to move the whole thing in because then we can truly capture the great attempt and the noble failure.
Well, that's brilliant. Thank you, Evelyn. I think I can promise we'll take care of the Dragon Gate a lot better than some of its previous owners. Tell you what, it can go next to Schubert's Unfinished Symphony.
Dr. Allen, what exhibit would you like to donate to the museum?
I would like to offer the museum a mechanical beard with detachable whiskers from the 19th century because I think it, A, highlights the importance of facial hair such that somebody would want to invent such a thing, but B, it shows us the wonderful ingenuity of Victorians and their contraptions.
So talk me through what I get when I buy a 19th century mechanical beard.
Okay, so even at the low end models, you get a false beard, which has as little system to it. It's a slightly elastic thing that adheres to your face, because if you think, the sort of person would want a mechanical beard wants it to look natural. So there would be nothing worse than being out in polite company, say walking through the park with the ladies, a gust of wind blows and your deceit is laid bare for the whole world to see. Your false beard flies up or worse off.
So the word mechanical beard suggests that it moves in some way, that it's sort of, you know, is it made of metal?
Well, unfortunately, I've never actually seen one in real life. But it seems to me that there's a sort of little armature of springs and wire. And then the hair is put on top of that. So it's more than just, let's say, the theatrical false beard, which is glued on or stuck on. This is a piece of work. And the Victorians are very good at giving their devices really elaborate names. So, you know, why would you be a hat maker when you can be an hydrotobolic hat maker? You know, so they give you these really over highfalutin names. So, yeah, not just a false beard, it's a mechanical beard.
And did women ever wear these beards to pretend to be men?
What I have seen is supposedly women growing the love locks down underneath the chins in imitation of whiskers. And that happened in the mid-19th century. It's mentioned in a couple of the magazines. There are sort of these wonderful ladies' fashion magazines called things like Le Belle Epoque. And they bring into what are the latest fashions being seen around the London parks, you know, these sorts of things. And yes, this is mentioned a couple of times. I've never seen any photo of a lady doing this or any illustration, but it was a thing. Apparently.
What's a love lock?
Oh, so like the equivalent of sideburns then, but just growing the sides of the hair down. Which love locks would be the little curl, but you just grow them underneath.
And then a little ponytail under the chin, and Bob's your uncle, you've got a small goatee.
Yeah.
And was shaving by this point a big thing? I mean, did most people shave?
With the Victorian beard movement, there's like a sort of publicity campaign, and they make the most outrageous claims as to why men should wear beards. So, for example, they say that it is nature's filter against all the bevy of evils lurking in the urban air. Well, like you say, what happens if you just don't want to grow a beard? And this was a problem with the research. Given that most of the photos that we see of Victorians are going to be elite guys, aren't they? Elite and sort of better off having their portraits taken. So the one way I found to do this was Victorian prisoner photographs. The photographs taken just after somebody is arrested and imprisoned, and they become, or they're invented around about the same time as the beards movement comes in. So I did a study of these to see what styles they're wearing, and actually a large proportion of them didn't have a beard. An equally disappointingly large proportion of them didn't have what we would think of as the archetypal Victorian beard, the massive edifice, the cathedral beard as it's known. They had the chin strap beard. It seemed to be enormously popular across three different parts of Britain that I looked in. So yes, there were a large percentage of guys, or a proportion of them, that didn't have a beard. So it can't have been ubiquitous. It wasn't that literally every guy in Britain thinks, oh, I better get myself one of these, and then out comes the cathedral beard. There's a variety of styles.
Evelyn, let me just ask you, have you ever been tempted to pop out in a false beard?
Oh, I would love to grow a beard. I mean, it would be wonderful. I mean, if you have facial hair, it really disguises your actual face. I've seen friends who have facial hair and then they shave it and I don't even recognize them, and it's a bit jarring. So I would love to. It is that classic Charlie Chaplin villain type of thing where you can just dress up and you can be whomever you want to be and just sneak around.
I was a kids' TV presenter for a few years, or for a short period, and I had to wear a lot of stick-on moustaches. And it's one of the tragedies of my life that I really suit a moustache. And if I had more guts, I would just embrace that and go out and wear it. I've got a great face for facial hair, and I look like a sort of young Robert Redford. It really suits me.
I love this. Thank you, Dr. Allen. Thank you for this marvellous mechanical beard. We'll make sure it's well-oiled with WD-40 and keep it safely under lock and Allen key. In your honour.
Allen, what would you like to give to the museum?
Well, after some persuasion, I'm still a bit unsettled about this. And mainly because for about 30 years I've been collecting first editions of a series of books written by a gentleman called Captain W.E. Johns. And I speak of the Biggles books, which filled my childhood and my even adult brain with yarns, just cracking tales. There are 103 by my count, and I got keen on them, firstly as a reader, and secondly as the fact that my prep school was right opposite the house in which the writer himself lived back in those days. And to be able to look up across the river and see a slender fellow working his garden and knowing that when he finished that, he was going to go back into his study and write the entertainments that he did write, are so fulfilling to a child's imagination that I want everybody to have the advantage of them. The point about them is this massive collection, which is greater in my estimation in volume terms than Balzac, who was until recently my number one favourite writer. Mm. He was a very prodigious writer, but nothing knee-high to Captain W.E. Johns. So I'd like to contemplate giving Biggles adventures to the museum. I can't give them away. I will allow you to make copies.
Is there a specific Biggles book that you absolutely loved, or was it the first one that you read that got you hooked?
Do you know, it's a longer relationship than just being at it again as an adult. I was also asked in the 60s or 70s to do a Biggles movie and sat down with my then writing partner, and we wrote a cracking story about Biggles, to the point where the studio went and built six Sopwith Camels, which were the aeroplane of the period, and our Sopwith Camel had its wings in a different place to the original one. So nobody actually knew who was going to fly. We all gathered round, the pilot jumped into the cockpit on a field, just a field, and off this thing took. He went straight into a loop, the loop, in the air above him. He then did an Immelmann plunge, which I had some complicated turn sideways, and landed again. And, of course, you knew from that alone that the movie was going to be perfect. But what made it perfect for me was we had our set designer working on it, and he came up with a drawing, wonderful detailed drawing. Biggles was in the middle of the desert, the heart of the Sahara Desert, and his office was just a Nissen hut. And in the Nissen hut, to comply with regulations, was two large buckets that said sand in case of fire.
Ah, funny. So did the movie get made then?
No, it didn't, sadly. Somebody else acquired the rights some years later, and I haven't seen their movie.
So they went to all that effort of literally building a replica aeroplanes and stuff, and then never made it.
Yes, it's what accountants call showbiz.
May I ask, did you ever meet Captain Johns, or was he just, you admired him from afar?
No, I was a child. There is an actual end to that story. The building that he lived in was a 17th century building with huge Victorian additions. It was an immense house. And I'm glad to say that 35 years later, after I'd left school, my company bought it as the headquarters of the company.
Wow.
So there we are, living with the ghost of Captain Johns.
That's absolutely amazing, Alan. You've certainly given us our Bigglesworth there. Well, we can park his Sopwith Camel on the lawn so it doesn't make a mess of the mess.
Thank you.
So there we have it. The museum's collection now boasts an admirable aviator, a doomed development, and some metallic mutton chops, all of which sound suspiciously like the key plot drivers in the next Mission Impossible movie. Thanks from Holly and me to Evelyn, Alan and Dr. Alan. And in the interest of balance, I leave you with two quotes about chess. The first from Thomas Hardy. Regarded as a game, chess is more intellectual than life, or bridge. And the second from Raymond Chandler. Chess is as elaborate a waste of human intelligence as you can find outside of an advertising agency. That's all from the museum this time. Goodbye.
The Museum of Curiosity was curated by John Lloyd and me, Holly Walsh. The donors were Evelyn Mock, Dr. Alan Withy, and Alan Scott. The exhibits were catalogued by Mike Shepherd, Mike Turner, and Jack Chambers of QI. The producer was Anne Miller, and it was a BBC Studios production.
Next week, John and Holly welcome John.